The young boy had a question for his mother. You always said the only thing that could make you think it's okay to kill another person is if someone hurt one of your kids. What are you going to do now? The year was 2007. The place was Abilene. The boy was 13-year-old Paris Lee Bennett. Why did Paris ask his mother such an odd question? Because he had just admitted to killing his 4-year-old sister. So how will you treat me now, Mom? I started with such a devastating story today, not to be provocative, but to make a point. The forgiveness that I'm going to talk about today is complex, high stakes. Anger, revenge, forgiveness, big topics. Let's start with the passage from the section of Matthew called the Sermon on the Mount that partially inspired this sermon. I'm starting in Matthew, the 5th chapter. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. And then from later in Matthew, the 5th chapter, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, give your coat as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Well, as I prepared for today's sermon, I went to one of my biblical commentaries that I rely on a lot, and I was immediately put on notice by a piece written by Ronald J. Allen. Here's what he says, right up front. When preaching on these verses, the preacher needs to avoid drifting into amateur psychology. Well, I sat with that for a while, uncomfortably, but then I thought, you know what, but that's exactly what the preacher must do. I believe that Jesus can be a great spiritual teacher, a teacher of wisdom, despite the fact that he lived in the first century. But we can't leave him there. We need to bring our own understanding of science, human behavior, psychology, all of it to bear on understanding Jesus' teaching. Jesus was not a scientist. He had no idea there would be atomic bombs or internet or airplanes or rocket ships. I often apply what I know of natural laws to what Jesus taught. Is it any different for me to apply what I know of psychology or emotional intelligence or shame or any of the studies that we have undertaken? I must wrestle intellectually and spiritually with all of this, and I must do it with honesty and humility. Let me share something I read that was written by Russell Moore. He's the editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, and he tells this little story. He says, multiple pastors tell me, essentially, the same story about quoting the Sermon on the Mount and, parenthetically, in their preaching, turn the other cheek. And often someone will come up to them and say, where did you get those liberal talking points? And what was alarming to Russell Moore, or to the people that were telling him this story, is that when the pastor would say to these people, I'm literally quoting Jesus, the response would not be, oh, I apologize. The response would be, yeah, but that doesn't work anymore. That's weak. Let me take it a little bit further. The former president's son, Donald Trump Jr., told a crowd that the teachings of Jesus have, quote, gotten us nothing. Here's his primary text. Quote, we've been playing T-ball for half a century while they're playing hardball and cheating. Right? Quote, we turned the other cheek, and I understand sort of the biblical reference. I understand the mentality, but it's gotten us nothing. He then went on to explain from his view what would get them something. Well, that's not the way to wrestle with these passages. The way to wrestle with these passages is with intellectual and spiritual honesty and humility. And we're going to do a little bit of that this morning, and we're going to start with anger. You have heard it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So, on its face, that's pretty stark, pretty clear. But if we drill down on it with honesty and humility, we see what's really important here. And what's really important is that Jesus is establishing a new order, a new realm, his realm. You have heard, but I say, this is Jesus putting us on notice. I am bringing a new day. So what might Jesus be saying about anger? Not that anger is wrong. Not that anger is worthy of hell. But rather, be careful with your anger. It's not only murder that you need to avoid, Jesus is saying. That's easy. That doesn't make the world a better place if we don't murder other people. But don't carry your anger around. Don't carry your anger around as accessible as your smartphone. Because if you do, you're going to find yourself pulling it out constantly, scrolling, commenting, sharing. If you are carrying your your anger around like a love letter from your wife, you're going to be under its influence, constantly reminding yourself of it. You know how that goes, right? When you don't deal honestly with your anger, you carry it around. You're always half a second from saying or doing something that you can't take back, from acting on impulse. You aren't safe until you acknowledge that anger and deal with it, and neither is anyone else. It's not anger that's bad. Anger is neutral, normal, human. Even Jesus was angry, but the difference is that Jesus had what the Eastern mystics call a mind like water. His response, even his anger response, was like the ripple that a stone causes when it's dropped into the pond. Appropriate, proportional, acknowledged, allowed to dissipate. And when anger that we're carrying around consumes us, we turn to revenge. You have heard it said, Jesus said, that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, give him your coat. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Again, Jesus was putting us on notice. You have heard it said, that revenge is fine, but must be proportionate. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I say, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Jesus is ushering in a new world order. If we keep giving back what we've received, the cycle never stops. Revenge is never satisfied. Revenge, getting even, is an illusion. It's like when you really want just a little bit of that chocolate cake, and you take this, and then that's not quite a whole, and that one's crooked, and that, it's all an illusion. It never ends. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this today because I've preached on it many times, but please take a look at the work of Walter Wink around those verses, turn the other cheek and go the second mile. Wink explains that these verses have been as harmful as any misinterpreted verses in the Bible. Jesus never wanted us to be doormats who would take any punishment and keep smiling. Jesus never asked us to be complicit with our own or anyone else's persecution. When Jesus said, turn the other cheek, Wink explains, he meant stand up for yourself. Not to return violence, but to stand up for yourself. He explains how if someone hits you on the cheek with their backhand, they are setting themselves up as your better. They are belittling you. They are pressing you. If you in turn turn the other cheek, then the person is given the choice of whether he wants to hit you on the other cheek, which means using the open hand, like equals, not like a servant, but like equals. Turn the other cheek, force them to see you. It's the same kind of thing with go the other mile, go the extra mile. Jesus says if someone asks you to go 1 mile, carry his pack 1 mile, head right into mile two without slowing down. Why? Because the rule of the land was that a soldier could demand that any bystander carry his pack. In fact, this is one of the ways that large armies were able to mobilize so quickly, by using civilians. But the law said the citizens only carried the pack 1 mile. More than that, and the soldier could be punished for breaking a military law. So at the end of the mile, if you are carrying the pack and you head into the second, you are breaking into the consciousness of the soldier. You're demanding, here I am. See me. I will not be your pack animal. Release me. How often Christians suffer and the church suffers because we will not stand up. Not in violence, but nonviolently. How often we participate in our own and others' oppression and call it turning the other cheek. And finally, forgiveness. And here is where my amateur psychologist kicked into overdrive. Forgiveness. Dr. Dabney Ewan, a surgeon specializing in burns, started doing an unusual thing. When severely burned patients came in, he started talking to them about anger and forgiveness. He noticed that when people came into the ER with burns, they were often very angry, and they had reason. They were hurt, they were in severe pain, often due to their own reckless mistake or someone else's. And as they would describe to him the accident that left them burned, their words, he thought, were often tinged with angry guilt or blame. He concluded that their anger might be interfering with their ability to heal by preventing them from relaxing and focusing on getting better. This is what Dr. Ewan said. I was listening to my patients and feeling what they were feeling, and it became obvious that this anger had to be dealt with. Their attitude affected the healing of their burns, and this was particularly true of skin grafts. With someone who was real angry, he said, we'd put 3 or 4 skin grafts on, and their body would reject them. Whenever a patient seemed angry, Ewan would help them forgive themselves or the person who hurt them, either through conversation or through simple hypnosis. Here's what happened. Once Ewan began helping his patients forgive, he noticed even more improvement. What you're thinking and feeling affects your body, he said. He would explain this to his patients. He would use the analogy of something embarrassing causing someone to blush. What you're thinking and feeling affects your body. What you're feeling will affect the healing of your skin, he would tell his patients. And we want you to put all your energy into healing. And at that point, he would learn how the victim had unthinkingly opened a blast furnace without turning it off, or how the workman at a construction site had repeatedly told the boss about a dangerous workplace, but nobody would respond. And then he said, I would do hypnosis with these patients and help them forgive themselves or the other person. And I would say, you can still pursue damages through an attorney. You're entitled to be angry, but for now, I'm asking you to abandon your entitlement and let it go. To direct your energy toward healing and to turn this over to God or to nature or whatever you worship. It's not up to you to get revenge on yourself or someone else. And he would say, when you know at a feeling level that you're letting this go, raise your hand. Then the doctor said, I'd shut up. They'd raise their hand, and I'd know that this skin graft was going to take. Dr. Frederick Luskin, the co-founder of the Stanford Forgiveness Project, said, when you don't forgive, you release all the chemicals of a stress response. Each time that you react, adrenaline, cortisol, norepinephrine, they enter the body. When it's a chronic grudge, one that you think about often, you release these chemicals into your body over and over. They limit your creativity. They limit your problem solving. Cortisol and norepinephrine cause your brain to enter what that no-thinking zone. And over time, they lead you to feel helpless, like a victim. When you forgive, he says, you wipe all of that clean. Forgiveness is good, and good for you. Okay, I really, really need you to stay with me as I wind this down. Forgiveness is good, and good for you, and godly. Here is one last section from the Sermon on the Mount from the 6th chapter. This then, Jesus said, is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your dominion come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. If you have internalized nothing else from this sermon series, I hope you have internalized this. The Sermon on the Mount is not a monolith. It is not everything you ever need to know about Jesus' teaching. It is a kernel. To To understand, you must read it, study it. Bring all that you have to bear upon it, your heart, your mind, and your soul, and your strength. Live it, love it, rebel against it. Don't fear it. Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Or as I learned it growing up, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. How many of us have been held captive by these words? I have not forgiven my father for beating me when he was drunk. God won't forgive me. I have not forgiven the colleague who spread rumors about me that cost me my job. God won't forgive me. I cannot forgive my husband who cheated on me repeatedly. God can't, won't forgive me. We have a forgiveness problem. But it's not that we don't forgive. It's that we don't really understand what forgiveness is. Try this. Forgiveness is to give up the desire or power to punish. Forgiveness does not mean to trust your abuser again. Forgiveness does not mean to remember your abusive father's birthday. Forgiveness does not mean you have to renew the friendship. Sure, reconciliation is part of God's great redeeming of humankind, but that's not what we're talking about. To forgive is to give up desire or power to punish. Period. Now let's go back to the prayer that Jesus taught us. And forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. God, in your mercy, give up your desire and your power to punish me. I have failed over and over, but you can forgive over and over. You watch me fail and you cover me with grace. I understand that you do not want blood sacrifice. You do not demand it. You love. God, I am going to try to give up my desire to punish. It never works anyway. And then I start to get it. The family members of the saints gunned down at Mother Emmanuel Church. The people saying, I forgive. When I was almost angry at them for forgiving, you know what I mean? Before the trial, before anything, they stood in the courtroom and said, I forgive you. And I wondered, didn't you love more than that? I was wrong. To forgive is not to stop seeking justice. We still speak truth to power. We speak truth about abusers. We never have to allow ourselves to be abused again. We never need to pretend to trust again, but we hand the consequences over. We hand the judgment and the punishment over to the authorities, to the social justice warriors. And there is great grief in this because one of the things we give up is we give up that desperate desire for things to have been different. If I'd only paid attention, if I had listened to my friends, if I had known you couldn't, wouldn't change. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who had plenty to forgive people for, said, forgiving means abandoning your right to pay back the perpetrator in his own coin. But it is a loss that liberates the victim. He says that there was a recent story in spirituality and health that had on its front cover a picture of three U.S. ex-servicemen standing in front of the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. And one asked the other, "Have you forgiven those who held you prisoner of war?" The response was, "I will never forgive them." To which his friend said, "Then it seems they still have you in prison, don't they?" Forgive is simply to give up the desire or the power to punish, to exact revenge. We've been through it, haven't we? Anger, revenge, forgiveness, prayer, salt, light, covenant, the golden rule. We have been through it. But here's what I know with certainty as we come to the end. And I started to get at it last week when I was talking about you can build a house on sand. What matters is what your foundation is. In fact, when we're talking about our faith, a house on sand might be preferable because you know that sand gets all in everything. It pervades everything. You can't get rid of it. That's how faith can be when we build it carefully. Here's what I realized about this Sermon on the Mount. I can only break it into these little pieces, these little phrases, these little words, if I commit myself to starting from there. To go to the other passages, the other stories, the other teachings, my own experience, to bring those to bear. Because here's, I don't know if this is going to make sense to you, but here's what I understand now. Jesus is his own body of work. Not just the scripture. It's not just a song. It's not just the preaching. Jesus is his own body of work. You got to get close to that to understand it. Today we end the series on the Sermon on the Mount. But trust me, this Sermon on the Mount is only the beginning.